welcome to WYSO's 2012 Community Voices Special. I'm Sarah Buckingham. This hour, radio stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley, produced in this year's Community Voices training course. From memories of your first car, to man caves, funk music, and a local slasher flick.
Slasher films are those horror films from the 1980s, where a maniac offs a group of attractive young people with a machete, or a pair of garden shears, or a shish kebab skewer.
This is the second installment of a two-part special. Last week, we heard about a new microbrewery in Yellow Springs, Burundian refugees growing an urban garden, and a profile of local artist Winnie Fiedler. If you missed the first part of our special, check it out at wyso.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our mailing list to find out how you can become a Community Voices producer. WYSO has a long history of community involvement. When the station first went on the air, it was all student-run. Today, WYSO is a blend of highly creative professionals and volunteers who strive to be deeply engaged with the community. We're proud of that history of community engagement, and we want to get even more local voices on the air. So we started teaching people how to make radio stories. In this hour, we'll hear stories produced in WYSO's 2012 Community Voices training course. Our first story comes from Judy Welly. Judy is a retired teacher and a self-described NPR junkie. She loves the public radio storytelling style, and so she came to WYSO to learn how to do it herself. Judy brings us a story on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which we usually associate with combat veterans. But research by Dr. Barbara Steffens of Westchester, Ohio, shows a high instance of PTSD in the partners of sex addicts.
PTSD begins with a traumatizing event, often exacerbated by additional experiences. The condition is complicated when triggered by stimuli associated with that trauma. The initial trauma for partners of sex addicts is often the day they discover they are living with a stranger who has affairs or illicit sex or is pornography obsessed, who has a secret life outside their relationship. The trauma is repeated as they learn the ways their partner has and will betray and deceive to continue the addiction. Even if the relationship ends or the addict gets into recovery, the resulting partner's PTSD is challenging to heal. Partners of sex addicts, most often women, no longer know what is real or what to trust. Their whole existence is threatened. It becomes difficult to be fully functional.
Once disclosure happens and her world's shattered, she's still expected to be wife, mother. She's working, you know, professional person on the job. You don't get time off for this. You know, we're lucky to, in our society, get 3 days off if we're grieving the loss of a loved one. We get no time when our whole lives have just been shattered due to sex addiction and this kind of betrayals.
As they struggle with the loss of the primary relationship in their life, other costs accumulate.
They experience all sorts of other pressures and losses. Because they've been so traumatized, they've had a difficult time even functioning at work and losing their jobs, losing occupations, having to walk away from things that they love to do because they didn't have the energy, the ability to focus on that.
As Dr. Steffens interviewed partners of sex addicts about trauma, one symptom kept popping up, an inability to read.
It's almost like they have attention deficit disorder. They can't focus in. They get lost a lot. And even for some can lose the capacity to focus enough to be able to make sense of words on a page and to have those make sense in their brain.
But that's just a small piece of the PTSD experience. The voices you're about to hear are reading quotes from Dr. Steffen's research and her responses about them.
I loved my husband, and I wanted his comfort, yet he was the source of my searing pain. It left me feeling shell-shocked.
Those are words we often hear from combat veterans who have PTSD. I hear that in most of the partners I talk to. We have this expectation that when we are in a committed relationship, that that's our safe place, the place we go when we're beat up out in the world. And the person we would normally go to is the one who just hurt us more than anyone else ever had. So their safe place disappeared.
I felt terror, anger, and rage, and fury at God.
So it can set up a spiritual crisis as well, of feeling unsafe even in that safe place in their life. Another woman said, I had fear for my health and for our children. When a woman finds out about sex addiction and hidden sexual behaviors and betrayal, she automatically goes to, am I safe? Do I have a disease? Have I been exposed to something? And then she goes to her children. Did something happen with my kids? Have they seen something, heard something, witnessed something? Has something happened to them? So it raises fears not only for her own safety, but for the whole family.
I had disturbing dreams.
This is the kind of traumatic event that invades every area of our life, even our sleep. So they have nightmares. But for some women, avoiding sexual contact at all costs is paramount for them because it's so triggering and so fear-provoking.
How could I be in bed and be intimate with someone when there are so many other women in the room?
In addition to emotional and occupational struggles, the prolonged stress of PTSD often results in physical illnesses.
I cannot tell you how many partners I work with who, as part of the stress they've been under, have developed a form of cancer. Normally breast cancer is what I seem to hear the most. But cancer or chronic fatigue or other kinds of just chronic conditions that they have to deal with.
So what do you do? Will divorce or ending the relationship fix the PTSD?
Don't think that divorcing is going to somehow take a big eraser to the trauma that you've just endured. Divorcing isn't a solution in terms of dealing with the PTSD. It may reduce future trauma. Absolutely, it can do that. So if you've already developed post-traumatic stress symptoms in response to sex addiction, getting a divorce is not going to undo it. In the relationship or out of the relationship, you still have to deal with the wounding and get assistance, get support, get help, and do whatever it takes to take good care of yourself so that you survive and thrive.
PTSD can last a lifetime, but there is hope. If the person finds safety and support post-trauma, the symptoms can be managed and life fully lived.
If a partner is able to get those things and have that for a prolonged period of time, there is every reason in the world to believe she's going to have a good outcome. That, yeah, there may be some residual symptoms that hang on over a period of time, but the severity of the symptoms should get better.
This is Judy Welly with WYSO's Community Voices.
Dr. Steffen's book is called Your Sex Addicted Spouse: How Partners Can Cope and Heal. Next, Antioch College student Jennifer Carlson asks the question,
if you could wake up anywhere in the world tomorrow, where would it be?
I don't know.
Egypt.
Back home in Florida. I don't know, I miss my friends, my family, it's been a while.
Either Oregon or France.
Probably right here. I think it would disorient me too much if I woke up anywhere else. I'm not a big traveler.
I would like to be able to wake up and not know where, like, what country I'm in, and, like, have to be able to figure it out through my day. I think that would be really cool.
I will have to say where I am now.
I've been wanting to go to Montreal lately, so we'll try that.
What's the question? If you could wake up anywhere in the world tomorrow, where would it be?
I can't really think of anywhere to wake up, because every time I think about different places around the world in which I wake up, I'm horribly anxious every time I do it.
I would wake up at my grandparents' house in upstate New York in the summertime.
Somewhere in the past. Maybe at my summer camp in the past, like 5 years ago, I think.
Oh, also probably actually at middle of the rainforest with like toucans and rivers.
Outer space.
Oh. Hopefully in the ocean. But if not in the ocean, maybe in the ocean. Definitely in the ocean. I don't think there's anywhere else I'd rather be.
That was a Vox Pop from Jennifer Carlson. Vox Pops are a collection of different people's answers to the same question, gathered through random interviews on the street. Here's another one from Yellow Springs resident Wally Ream.
My first car was a 47 Plymouth.
A 67 ragtop Camaro.
I think it was a Studebaker. I think it was.
Yes, I remember my first car. It was a piece of junk.
Working together with my 16-year-old son on his used car got me feeling nostalgic. I decided to ask around the Miami Valley and see what folks remembered about their own first cars.
Very first car I owned, oh my Lord, was a Chevy. And it was a 1956. It was absolutely in mint condition. And I loved it.
1978 Chevette, and it wouldn't go any faster than 55 miles an hour.
After a while, these little poofs of black smoke would come out the heaters.
I dented it immediately, and I've continued to dent it ever since.
My first car would have been a 78 Monte Carlo, but I had my permit, and I totaled it. Dad just looked at me and said, well, there was your 17th birthday present. I said, well, if I know Dad, I wouldn't have been driving it.
It was a 1956 Chevy, all jacked up and hot riding for the day. Canary yellow with black interior.
It's brown. I can't give you the exact shade because you'd probably have to bleep it out.
I know when my wife first saw it, she said, where's the rest of the engine?
The crash?
Yes. It didn't work well after that.
What happened?
Well, it got bent. I went to jail.
And it was a 48 Mercury, and that's about all I can remember.
The windows didn't go down in the back, the horn didn't blow, and the windshield wipers didn't work.
It shouldn't have been surprising, but I found that when you ask someone about their first car, you often get more than a story. You get a smile and a sparkle in the eye. For WYSO, I'm Wally Ream.
Making a Vox Pop like the one we just heard is sort of an intro to radio production, and it's one of the first things our Community Voices trainees do. Our training course starts each January. It meets once a month over 6 months. About a dozen people from all over the Miami Valley and from a variety of backgrounds converge at WYSO to learn how to do radio. Recording, editing, interviewing, writing, and mixing. And we cap it off with a public presentation of the audio documentaries they've created, a screenless screening at the Film Dayton Festival, and a masterclass with a radio great like Susan Stamberg or Ira Glass. But it all starts with an idea, and story ideas can come from anywhere. Will Davis stumbled upon his story when he saw an 80s slasher movie that turned out to be a recent release by local filmmaker Justin Russell. Russell created his film The Sleeper as an homage to a genre that peaked in popularity before he was even born. Here's Will Davis with the story.
Slasher films are those horror films from the 1980s, where a maniac offs a group of attractive young people with a machete, or a pair of garden shears, or a shish kebab skewer. I recently discovered a film called The Sleeper, and at first I thought it was a lost slasher film, but it's a new film, made to look like an old film. And it was made in Springfield, Ohio, by a local filmmaker named Justin Russell. Intrigued by this, I friended Justin on Facebook, and then met him at his apartment.
How's it going? You are literally in Gamma Knife Films HQ right now. You can literally see my bed from where we're standing, my couch, my desk. All of these posters that you're looking at are original prints.
Original posters for classics like Friday the 13th, Prom Night, and Don't Go in the House adorn the walls of Justin's apartment and are a not-so-subtle reminder of why we should always avoid a stranger wearing a hockey mask and carrying a nail gun. Justin's collection of horror DVDs is vast and includes every slasher film I've ever seen, and then some. Surrounded by so many celluloid nightmares, Justin was inspired to create his own.
I was sleeping in my apartment, and I looked over at my bedroom door in the middle of the night after I woke up out of a dream or something, and it was open a crack. And I thought I shut my door. And I thought, that would be a really great slasher movie if somebody killed you in your sleep. So I clipped on my light and wrote that down really quick, like, yeah, you know, somebody kills you in your sleep, whatever, and fell back asleep. Woke up in the morning and thought, the morning light is now coming in. It's still a good idea, so I'm going to go ahead and do it.
Justin wrote The Sleeper in 8 weeks and began production shortly thereafter in his hometown on the campus of Wittenberg University. In addition to its locations, Springfield was the perfect city for the 2-week shoot for another reason. Justin's parents catered the film. In The Sleeper, a group of sorority sisters are methodically dispatched by a madman with an axe to grind. Literally. And in true slasher film fashion, the killer prefaces each attack with a twisted telephone call.
I'll get it. Hello? Hello?
The Sleeper was shot with all the latest digital equipment, but in post-production, Justin added optical effects to his movie, like chromatic abrasion and desaturated color grading, to give the film a dated look. Then he ran the soundtrack through a filter to mimic the low-fidelity sound associated with low-budget films. Finally, Justin released The Sleeper on video cassette.
I actually saw all these films for the first time on VHS. And I used to go to the video store and think, oh man, I have to see this. It looks so terrifying and that kind of thing. You know, if I was a young 12-year-old again, would The Sleeper be something I'd want to see? Would I look at that cover and think, oh, I have to see it? And it would.
The day I met Justin, he prepared to ship his daily orders. And in one more nostalgic detail, labeled each video cassette with a sticker that politely reminded its viewer to be kind and rewind.
I just love putting these together for people to enjoy. It's a rush.
While The Sleeper is also available on contemporary formats like video on demand, DVD, and a soon-to-be-released Blu-ray disc, it's the dead format that has garnered the most enthusiasm. Justin's heard from fans around the globe grateful for the retro horror experience he's painstakingly produced for them, and eager to experience The Sleeper on VHS.
It's really cool. We've shipped all over the world. Brazil, Belgium, Sweden, Germany, UK.
But just as the internet and social media allow slasher film fans and lovers of VHS to find each other, it also makes piracy and theft very easy. In addition to legitimate sales, Justin's seen his movies stolen online. It's an unfortunate reality for any artist whose work is digital when peer-to-peer file sharing is commonplace. But maybe there's a bright side. After all, popularity, even among thieves, is never a bad thing when building a fan base and doing what you love.
It means people are seeing the film, and what I need to do is maybe research then how I can supercharge this piracy into working for my benefit. Even if I don't make back the budget on the sleeper, what I wanted it to afford me was the opportunity to make more films.
For WYSO Community Voices in Yellow Springs, Ohio, I'm Will Davis.
Daytonian Kristen Wicker came to a weekend workshop at WYSO last November. It was sort of a preview of the six-month Community Voices training course. We pulled back the curtain and demonstrated the production process from start to finish. Kristen says ever since that weekend, she's been hearing things. It opened her ears. She began to notice the squeak of a creaking door, the inflection in a person's voice, the sounds of the city around her. Now Kristen's hooked on radio. She's been producing stories for WYSO ever since, everything from celebrity boxing to new pop-up shops opening in downtown Dayton. And now she's working on WYSO's Reinvention Project. For more info on that, visit facebook.com/reinventionstories. Kristen took our full-length training course and produced this story about man caves.
Men, once rulers of the universe, nowadays have become equals to women and, in some cases, relegated to a back seat. One reaction to this social reality? The man cave, increasingly common throughout the United States. Heck, there are TV shows, websites, and books dedicated to these spaces designed by and for men. But why, in this era of, hey girl, has a space for male bonding become so important? University of Dayton sociology lecturer Jean Holcomb offers one explanation.
We've seen a shift in terms of like some spaces that used to be traditionally masculine spaces aren't anymore. So like the workplace is not necessarily as male dominated as it used to be. So to some extent we might be seeing a shift out of the workplace into other areas.
In an informal survey distributed via my Facebook page, 40 of 41 respondents indicated they know anywhere from 1 to a whopping 50 people with a man cave. Respondents described those spaces as everything from gross, unkempt, and stinky to rad, amazing, and the total package, a place that keeps men out of strip clubs, where they can fart with impunity and examine their private manly thoughts. In general, survey respondents noted these spaces give men a place where boys can be boys, where men can relax and unwind without worrying about the carpet matching the window treatments matching the scented candles. Jeremy Forbes, a sociology professor at UD, said he has a woodworking shop in his garage that functions as a sort of man cave, where his male friends can hang out, drink beer, and look at tools.
What we're seeing now is kind of an overall decline in like traditional civic engagement, where in the past men could join the Elks, the Rotary Club, neighborhood groups, things of that nature. What we're seeing is a shift in society. We're becoming a more mobile society. Those roots aren't nearly as deep as they used to be. So this may be a reaction to less involvement in other community groups. So they try to recreate some identity and man space within the home.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe women just want to get their men out of their space for a minute.
She asked me why. I just went on told her.
Indeed, women are generously allowing men to set up shop in garages, basements, and attics across America. My Facebook survey reveals the majority of man caves are in the home, but not all of them. Some guys are really lucky. Dayton resident George Baylog and three of his close friends have a man cave dubbed the Clubhouse in what he calls an undisclosed location near downtown Dayton on the third floor of an old warehouse.
That was the book that I had.
We almost got kicked out the very first night that we had this space set up. And we were so exhilarated at having this space, just full of the potential of this place, that we just went a little nuts and it got really loud. It went way into the morning. We were playing Pink Floyd really loud. And somebody taped us, took it to the landlord. We've toned it down since, and thank God they didn't kick us out.
Since that nearly tragic incident years ago, the clubhouse has evolved into the ultimate testosterone-fueled party pad.
There are concert posters, political stuff, bourbon bottles. It's almost like a scrapbook of our lives for the past couple of years. And whenever we go out different places, we'll bring back things on our trips to Ireland, our trips to New York, our trips to L.A., and stuff will come back from those things and go up on the wall. So it's kind of like a walk down memory lane in here. One of the nice things about being here, away from where I live, you never know who's going to knock on that door. You never know what's going to happen. There's sort of an element of randomness and chaos over here. So it's kind of like a Las Vegas thing, like what goes on here stays here.
Like so many of the spaces described by my survey respondents, the clubhouse serves an important role for Balog and the other men who call it their cave.
You know, you hear the word bonding, you know, it's kind of cliche almost, but you get to see each other in circumstances here and talk about things here that you don't talk about other places. You think back when you had best friends. And most of that usually comes around high school, sometimes in college. If you're lucky enough, you have that for the rest of your life. And I think this is an important part of keeping the quality of the friendship. You can be yourself. We travel together. We do a lot of things outside of here. But a lot of it is cemented and talked about and strengthened, you know, here.
Even still, the clubhouse is not exclusively a boys' club. The clubhouse crew hosts final listening parties, champagne and bourbon tastings, and soirees that invariably include impromptu karaoke sessions with groups of people gathered around a vintage mic stand. To those parties, you can hear music and laughter pouring from the windows while standing in the parking lot three stories below. In those moments, the clubhouse serves a purpose for men and women alike. So while the man cave may be a staple when it comes to male bonding in the modern age, perhaps it also is a reminder that, in the end, men and women have many of the same needs for friendship and fun. Don't stop. For WISO Community Voices, this is Kristen Wicker.
You're listening to the second installment of WYSO's 2012 Community Voices Special, radio stories produced in this year's training course. I'm Sarah Buckingham. If you missed the first part of our special, check it out at wyso.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on future workshops and training opportunities. Still to come this hour, a history of Dayton funk, a group of first graders having a book release party, and an introduction to shape note, or sacred harp singing. It's a traditional form of a cappella folk music. It originated in England and later migrated to the northeastern United States in the mid-1800s. From there, it made its way to the Deep South, where it put down roots and flourished. And in the last 50 years, the tradition has experienced a resurgence and spread throughout North America. In this next story, Alan Steiger takes us to a singing right here in Dayton.
The human voice that's the sacred harp, and when a group of voices get together to share their spirits and turn up the volume, it can rattle the walls and make you feel like you're on the inside of a musical instrument, even when they break it down to the basics. This living tradition is thriving locally thanks to the members of the Dayton Sacred Harp. Michelle Call drives from Louisville, Kentucky to attend the monthly gatherings.
I got involved with this through two hobbies, through Shape Note and through Civil War reenacting. Started slowly going to singing, and a couple of years later, met Greg Howard and Vic Wisman at a reenactment. They were singing around the fire, playing instruments, and had some books, and I said, you all have to hear this. You'll have to give this a try. Both were pretty good musically, that they could pick up really quick and read. So that Sunday morning, that was our church, singing Sacred Harp around the campfire.
And this is Greg Howard.
We started singing out of this book. It was like we got hit with a bolt of lightning. Fortunately, John Baer heard that I was wanting to start a singing in Dayton. And he called me up. And we were singing to each other on the phone. Vic and I went to John's house, and it was John and his wife, Lorraine, and their three children, who at that time were very young. We just sat around their dinner table. That was the very first singing in Dayton.
Also at that dinner table.
I'm Jubal Bear, and I'm 15. And I remember them coming to the house, meet Pa for the first time. For some reason, I thought angels were coming. I don't know why, but I was really small. I started singing together, maybe four or five. It only started getting beyond 12, 15 people 4 years ago. And from there, it's bloomed.
We will sing with the angels there, in the heavenly home so fair, in heaven above where all is love. We will sing with the angels there.
Since those first get-togethers back in 1999, the singers have grown from a handful of voices to as many as 100 at a time. At its core, the act of sacred harp singing is a social event and transcends religious beliefs or economic status. Everyone is welcome. This is Jeff Fife from Fairborn.
Something that can't be described, it really has to be experienced, because you don't just hear it, you also feel it. Sonic vibrations that pulse through your body when you're singing and when you're hearing this is just incredible.
The singers arrange themselves in four sections of chairs, all facing inward toward an empty center. Again, Jeff Fife.
The fact that everybody is facing each other really is one of the aspects of this that makes it so enjoyable. You get to see the other people's faces, and it's so non-judgmental. If you can sing, great. If you can't, that's fine too. Come on, join up. Common everyday people. You don't have to have sung music anytime or any place. You can just show up and join in for your own personal enjoyment. We'll feed you real good.
Go a couple times, it just gets its hooks into you.
Susan Zerker from Dayton.
And the wonderful thing for me is that it's not a rehearsal and it's not a performance. You just go and sing as a community, and that is just wonderful.
How does it make you feel physically as you're singing it?
The act of singing is good for your body. There have been studies that show laughing is good for your physical body. Well, so is singing. And when you sing loudly, it just jazzes you up. And sometimes, like today on our first song, I had to stop because I was tearing up because it was just so beautiful. I have to stop and collect myself and go on. It's 3 hours. We sing, eat, and sing, and that's a lot of fun. I just love it.
Cradle harper is a term that signifies someone who was born into this style of music because their parents were active Shape Note singers. What is your name?
Annalisa.
How old are you?
I'm 7 years old.
When did you first start singing this kind of music?
Since I was born, actually.
Did you talk before you could sing, or did you sing before you could talk?
I sang before I could talk, because I was born in the music. Music was playing in the delivery room when I was born.
Do you think there's enough kids to keep this kind of music going after the older people stop?
Probably.
Would you be one that would be a leader in it?
Mm-hmm. Since I know it a lot, I want to do it. Seems like there's something that I really like in it, just something special to me.
Hans Baer, who was also born into the music, describes some of the special dynamics of Sacred Harp singing.
If you're singing, you can hear your neighbor. You're not singing loud enough. Sing full voice. That's what full voice means. You don't control it or try and tone it down. Just enough off to sound magical. Eerie quality that makes it hang in the air.
Do you see yourself continuing on as you grow older?
Yeah. It's something I would like to pass on to my children, yes. Traditions are a good thing. It helps break down generational barriers. It allows you to communicate things that you feel to other people. That's what it's all about, is community. The music and the book is just a medium for people to get together and enjoy each other's company and to do something they love doing.
For WYSO, Community Voices, I'm Alan Steiger, and this is the Dayton Sacred Harp.
It's not every day that a 6 or 7-year-old finishes first grade and helps illustrate and write their own book. That's just what Mrs. Scavone's first grade class did. It's an ABC book, and it's called All About Nature. Jennifer Carlson brings us this sound portrait of a book release party at Mills Lawn Elementary in Yellow Springs.
When we get to a page that everyone helped, we'll all read that part together. So you can just follow along in your own stories, okay? Are you ready?
Q is for quicksand that sinks in the ground. O is for octopus that has 8 wiggly arms. J is for jaguar that claws trees. V is for violets that go with each wing. I did J because I like the sound that it makes. I really like the little V and it's in my name a lot.
And how does it feel to be a published author?
It feels good in my heart.
It feels really good. I think I did a lot of hard work.
I did X. X is for Xantus, a hummingbird that flies so high.
P is for Python who doesn't have many charms.
What was your favorite part about doing this book?
It's kind of like all about nature, and it can maybe help you learn about nature. My favorite part about it is that we worked as a group, and we didn't fuss about our letters if they didn't get the pick or anything.
All About Nature by Mrs. Scavone's first grade class.
We close this hour with a history lesson from Basim Blunt. Basim says that more funk bands came from Dayton than any city in the world. In his story, we'll hear about 6 bands that came from the West Side. During the 1970s and 80s, these bands secured record deals and went on to become nationally known artists. Many of the musicians continued to live in Dayton at the peak of their fame. Basim talks with some of these musicians and learns about one community's attempt to reclaim this unique piece of American music history.
I used to watch the Ohio players practice when I was a kid in a garage. I'm a funketeer, I'll be a funketeer for life. Because it was part of me, and I'm a part of that era. I love funk.
That's Daytonian Harold Rimblett Jr., a true funketeer. Me, I'm not from Dayton. I'm from Jersey City, a subway stop from the Big Apple and music nirvana. Growing up in the 70s, Dayton, Ohio was nowhere on my radar, but funk music sure was. It was the soundtrack of Afro Sheen commercials and Brown Skin Honeys doing the bump on Soul Train. On the weekends, me and my crew stood in line for hours to see groups like Slave, Heatwave, The Ohio Players, and Lakeside set New York on fire. Those were the days. Fast forward 30 years and I find myself with a wife, house, and kids, and living where else? In Dayton, Ohio. How could I have known that one day I would be meeting many of my music idols at the local Walmart? What's more amazing is that there's no trace of Dayton's music history within the city. So now I'm like, what the funk is going on? The Ohio Players were the first band to set it off in a big way. The 1974 record, Skin Tight, went gold and held number one on the charts for 7 weeks. The Players were Dayton's first music superstars. You are bad, bad misses. And them skin tight riches. Running folks in ditches. Pretty up by the bus of stitches. Yeah. Skin tight. Skin tight. Bassist Marshall Jones is one of the original Ohio Players. He is Bass Buddha, the Tony Soprano of the bass clef.
I'm the one that made that famous song, and I get emails from all over the world of bass players are telling me about how they was impressed and that they grew up on my music and so forth. Because I wasn't that crazy about Skin Tight. I wanted to change some parts in it, and he said, no, man, that's the groove.
The Players were on fire. They followed up Skin Tight with a streak of 4 number one hits, 2 Grammy nominations, and a European tour. Marshall says that staying in Dayton allowed the Players to mentor to the next generation of musicians who are hungry for a taste of fame.
Dayton has kept us grounded. We were stars to the world, but Dayton was our home. We were a true show band. All of the musicians, even though they were in school and learning, they had a world-class show band as a model. That's why so many groups came up out of Dayton.
One of those groups, Slave, was formed when Players trumpeter Pee Wee Middlebrooks brought his talented young nephew, Stevie Washington, to Dayton.
But Steve Washington lived in Jersey, and he was in his senior year in high school. So we did a performance in Newark, New Jersey, and Steve came to the show, and he begged his mama, I want to go back with my Uncle Pee Wee. So little Stevie came to Dayton, and he started Slave in Pee Wee's basement. Next thing you know, they're making hit records. Hits, I mean hits. And we weren't even taking them serious because they were teenagers.
Slave's first single, Slide, was an instant funk classic. It featured a groove driven by Mark Adams' signature slap bass sound. Sam Carter played keyboards for Slave and explains why the band's songs were so dance floor friendly.
People like to dance, particularly in the African American community. They like the freedom of dancing and expressing themselves, and funk gave a strong platform for that. The music scene here was very strong.
The Ohio Players were responsible for yet another Dayton discovery, when sax player Clarence Satchel discovered the house band at a local nightclub. That group was called Phazo. Keyboard player Keith Harrison remembers that evening.
We did our last gig at the Red Barn, and Satch was there. And he was in a one-piece leather jumpsuit. And after we finished, he said, I want to take you guys in the studio. If you're interested, be over at my house tomorrow. We went to Satch the next morning. We sat in his driveway, I think, man, for about 3 hours before he came out. And he said, I was testing y'all to see how bad did you want it?
Riding High stayed on the Billboard charts for an amazing 18 weeks and is still one of the most sampled songs in hip-hop. The group Heatwave was formed by brothers Keith and Johnny Wilder. They combined funk with disco on the multi-platinum selling Boogie Nights. And the hit-making band Lakeside struck gold with their single Fantastic Voyage, which was the first R&B record to record a rap performance. Way before Nicki Minaj and Lady Gaga, Dayton funk bands offered a visual stage show of costumes that were part Las Vegas and part sci-fi. One band that combined musicianship and showmanship was Roger Troutman and Zapp. Janetta Warren sang background on the band's debut smash, More Bounce to the Ounce.
The outfits we wore back then, the costumes, today the artists just walk up on stage in a pair of jeans and a shirt. That's not how it should be done.
Zapp ushered in the 80s with a techno-funk sound and Roger Troutman's trademark talk box that handled the vocals and melodies.
Roger really loved my voice because I could hit all the notes that he hit on the talk box, you know, being the techno sound and everything. And I just kind of matched him a lot, and so he really, really loved that.
In 1998, Michael Sampson was the first one to curate a museum exhibit that was dedicated to the Dayton funk scene. It was called Something in the Water.
Dayton loved these bands. They felt that these groups identified with them personally. The musicians, a lot of them have not received their due. They should. It did not have to be that we were the home of this powerful brand of music.
It's been more than 10 years since the Something in the Water exhibit closed. Now Sampson has partnered with the city's Wright Dunbar Neighborhood District Association and is planning to open up what will be called the Atlanta Funk Hall of Fame this fall. Michael takes me on a walk through the Wright Dunbar District. It's a revitalized section of 3rd Street. This is the street where the Atlanta Funk Hall of Fame plans to open in October 2012.
The subject matter is exciting. The music is exciting. We want the exhibition to be exciting. We're going to have posters. We're going to have photographs. And what we're going to do.
They say all things funk come from West Dayton. This is where it all happened. I hope Dayton can realize that fans from all over the world revere the music that came from this city. And what happened here was something that will never happen again. For Community Voices, this is Basim Blunt.
What? Say it now. Say it now. Yes. Me and the Ohio fans gonna tell you about a worm. He's the funkiest worm in the world. Okay, say it, fellas. There's a worm in the ground.
After finishing WISO's training course, Basim joined another Community Voices project. It's called Reinvention. We've teamed up with local filmmakers to create multimedia stories that explore the question, how does a city of inventors reinvent itself? More information about the Reinvention Project at WISO.org or at Facebook.com/reinventionstories. And next month, Basim will be attending the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. He's the recipient of a New Voices Scholarship. ¶¶ This has been part two of WYSO's 2012 Community Voices Special. I'm Sarah Buckingham, Community Voices Coordinator at WYSO. If you're wondering what exactly Community Voices is, it's sort of WYSO's third department, in addition to news and music. Community Voices is all about getting local people on the air. We help people from all over the Miami Valley record essays, poems, and commentaries. We work with public school teachers and college professors who want to bring radio into their classrooms. And each year, we gather a group of listeners and teach them to become producers. Our trainees learn to record and edit audio, conduct interviews, write for radio, and produce a feature story, like the ones you've just heard. Applications for next year's Community Voices training course will be available in November. Sign up for our mailing list to receive updates. You can do that at wyso.org. When asked about your interests, just select Community Voices. This hour, we've heard stories from Judy Welly, Jennifer Carlson, Will Davis, Kristen Wicker, Wally Ream, Alan Steiger, and Basine Blunt. If you missed any part of this hour or didn't catch part one last week, visit WYSO.org and click the Community Voices tab, where you can find all of the stories from Community Voices producers from this year and last. Community Voices projects are made possible by the DPNL Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. Thanks for listening, and keep an ear out for work from Community Voices producers Sunday mornings on WYSO Weekend. For WYSO, I'm Sarah Buckingham.